From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. When we want to do a program about Pennsylvania politics, we often call on John Baer, Harrisburg-based columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's been covering the state for a quarter of a century, so he knows the players and, shall we say, the state's unique brand of politics. And more than that, he's a very entertaining writer and guest. John has written a book documenting memorable and notorious government officials, 25 years of scandals, his short-lived career as a press secretary, and more. The book is titled On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics. He's speaking tonight at the Pen and Pencil Club in Philadelphia and joins us on Radio Times. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. More criminal charges today in the investigation of a deadly coal mine explosion in West Virginia 2 years ago. As NPR's Howard Berkus reports, a former executive at Massey Energy faces two federal conspiracy charges.
David Hugert spent a decade as president of one of Massey Energy's West Virginia subsidiaries and is charged in a federal criminal information with conspiring to derail surprise mine safety inspections and to cover up serious safety violations. Hugert's division did not include the Upper Big Branch mine, where 29 coal miners died in a massive explosion in 2010. And the charges are not directly related to that tragedy. But the filing suggests a plea agreement and cooperation as prosecutors aim higher up the corporate chain at Massey Energy. Hugert is the highest-ranking company official charged so far. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
A tear gas canister hits the ground in Cairo as demonstrators return to the streets over what's widely described as President Mohamed Morsi's power grab. He's not relented on his decrees essentially nullifying high court authority until a new constitution is written. The head of the assembly says a final draft of the constitution would be finished today. One leading opposition figure says it doesn't make sense because of popular anger at the constitutional assembly. Europe has dispatched some $48 billion today in loans to four troubled Spanish banks nationalized by the government last spring. From Madrid, Lauren Freyer reports Spain's bank bailout is expected to trigger thousands of layoffs in a country where unemployment already tops 25%.
The bulk of the money will go to Bankia, Spain's largest real estate lender, which had to be nationalized after the housing boom and bust. The bank will lay off 28% of its staff and close 1,100 branch offices in exchange for EU help. The European Antitrust Commissioner, who happens to be a Spaniard, announced the aid in Brussels. In order to stay alive, these banks will have to cut their balance sheets by 60%, Joaquin Almunia told reporters. Spain could still request more of the roughly $130 billion on offer from Europe when it evaluates other Spanish banks next month. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
NASA astronaut Tom Marshburn, a Canadian astronaut, and a Russian cosmonaut are getting ready for next month's scheduled launch to the International Space Station. Marshburn says they're heading into their final preparation tests and he feels good about them.
Final exams are to make sure everybody understands exactly how prepared we are. We feel very prepared for them. It's time to demonstrate that. And so we're coming in with a lot of confidence.
The three men will stay aboard the space station for the arrival of both commercial and Russian resupply vehicles. Wall Street stocks down in early trading, the Dow down 71 points, the Nasdaq down 22. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day. At wallacefoundation.org.
This is WHYY. I'm Joanne Allen. Good morning. New Jersey officials plan to impose sales taxes on medical marijuana. Taxation officials say that's consistent with the intent of lawmakers behind the recent law to allow patients to buy pot. So far, no dispensaries are selling marijuana to patients in New Jersey. The panel reviewing Pennsylvania's child abuse laws has issued a final report to the governor and the legislature. As WHYY's Mary Wilson reports, some recommendations concern the state's child abuse hotline.
Childline works 24/7 to take reports of child abuse, but it has long frustrated advocates and doctors who point to long hold times and a high number of dropped calls. The law creating Childline requires it to employ only full-time workers. Those slots are hard to fill, harder still because of the sometimes mandatory overtime that comes with the job. Rachel Berger is a Pittsburgh-area pediatrician specializing in child abuse and a member of the PA Task Force on Child Protection. She says one of the panel's suggestions for the understaffed hotline is to allow it to hire part-time employees.
There are many former and active Child Protective Services workers who have a tremendous amount of experience, who could staff that doesn't have to physically be at Childline, who could help staff this and provide additional coverage.
Berger also characterized Childline's methods of relaying reports to the police and other agencies as a game of telephone and says the office should adopt more efficient ways of taking and sharing information. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
Are you a maestro looking for work in Pennsylvania? The York Symphony Orchestra has an opening for a conductor and music director. The orchestra is accepting inquiries from potential candidates through mid-December. The search committee will choose four finalists who will guest conduct one concert during the 2013-2014 season as part of the final selection process. The Phillies catcher Carlos Ruiz is suspended 25 games next season for using amphetamines. And a federal mediator joins the NHL talks today. Money is the sticking point. Sunny and windy, a brisk day in store with highs only around 40 degrees. Currently in Center City, Philadelphia, 39 degrees. This is WHYY 1006.
I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania politicians have given John Baer a lot of material as a reporter and columnist who has covered Harrisburg for 25 years for the Philadelphia Daily News. His stories are a mix of irreverence, outrage, frustration, eye-rolling, and insight drawn from his many years as a journalist. He wrote that he wanted to call his new book, Pennsylvania Politics, You'll Laugh, You'll Cry, You'll Form a Mob, but he was overruled. Instead, it's titled On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. John Baer grew up in Harrisburg, where his dad worked as a reporter for the Patriot News. He normally joined us by phone from Harrisburg, and I'm happy to say he's with us here in our Philadelphia studios. And John Baer, nice to have you with us, and congratulations on your book.
Marty, thanks so much, and thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What made you think a book, 25 years?
Yeah, I think that was it. You know, a milestone like that, you kind of look back and say, well, you know, covered a lot of stuff. A lot of it was a lot of fun, and maybe I should share it. And I think people forget kind of the fun and goofy stuff that happens in Pennsylvania politics, and I had forgotten some of it. Unfortunately, I had some file cabinets full of stuff and went back and started looking through and
started
to come together, yeah.
So do you have a fun job? Would you describe it as a fun job?
More fun than any journalist has
really?
A right to have.
Yeah. And why is that?
Well, because of the nature of the state, and first of all, and secondly, the capital in Harrisburg really does provide an unending source of amusement to any journalist. Part of the book is dedicated to journalists who any journalist who has suffered the agony, the ecstasy of covering Pennsylvania politics. When you look back, I mean, there's just been great campaigns, great characters, a lot of corruption, which is good for my business, and just a lot of fun. Yeah, it's been a joy.
Well, it's interesting because you grew up in Harrisburg, you live in Harrisburg, your family is in Harrisburg. Is it the legislature, the politics that has kept you there, or is it just this is your familiar home territory?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a family decision. My wife and I both were only children, and when we had our own sons, we have two now grown sons, we made a decision fairly early on. Both sets of grandparents were there. And you don't see that very often anymore. And we made a decision. We wanted our sons to be raised in that kind of an atmosphere. Harrisburg, despite its reputation, is really a very easy place to live in. And I think my sons have thrived. We, enjoyed raising them there. And it was a good decision. Now, obviously, there were a lot of times, particularly when I was younger, when I was torn, you know, wanted to go to Washington.
The big city, right?
Yeah. But this job has allowed me, the Daily News, God bless it, has allowed me to get to Philadelphia often enough to enjoy the restaurants without paying the wage tax and still live the easy, clean living life that Harrisburg offers.
As I said, and as you write in this book, your dad was a reporter, correspondent for the Patriot News. What did he cover? Did he cover what you essentially have been covering?
He covered exactly what I covered. We missed each other by about 10 years. I began in journalism at the Patriot right after my dad had left, about 10 years after he had left. And for a while, it inured to my benefit because his name was John Bear also. So I would call people on the phone and we'd get right through because they thought it was my dad. But as I mentioned in the book, I actually grew up in that newsroom because journalists in those days were paid almost nothing. And he made more money freelancing than he
really
did as a full-time correspondent. So every Sunday, he would go to the newsroom and I would go with him and play on the phones, basically. And when I tell people that story, they always say, well, it's nice to see some things never change.
And get Cokes out of the Coke machine,
And get
too.
Cokes out of the Coke machine, yeah.
And this newsroom, as you said, in the Capitol, on the E floor?
On the E floor, right.
Is there a D floor and an F floor?
No.
There's just an E
There's
floor?
There's just the E floor, which I'm convinced was established to confuse any whistleblowers or taxpayers that wanted to get to the newsroom. It's actually, as I explained, it's a French word for entresol.
Yes.
It just means mezzanine. I don't know why they just couldn't say mezzanine. But all of the rooms on the E floor are 500 rooms. So I always wonder what people looking for the 500 rooms, you know.
And how different is that newsroom today compared to when you were 10 years old?
Totally different. it was, in those days, it was a wide open room like most newsrooms used to be. Today, like most newsrooms, it looks like, you know, an insurance office, a bunch of cubicles.
And a different sound,
And
right?
a different sound. Well, absolutely. It was typewriters back when I was growing up there. And everybody smoked and everybody drank and everybody had a bottle or a flask in their drawer. And it was a quite boisterous place. And that's not the case anymore. And the other big difference, Marty, that I think really impacts the way journalism operated and operates is that people lived in the city then, and people didn't go home after work. They went to the local bars and local taverns, politicians and reporters alike, and there was much more of a camaraderie, much less of a gotcha kind of approach to reporting in those days, and that's all gone now.
Yeah. Do you think there was too much chumminess, though? Because, again, you describe,
sure,
you know, parties and presents,
yeah,
and some back and forth.
Yeah,
between.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the our longstanding liquor control board, every holiday season, would bring literally baskets full of booze to the newsroom as gifts to the people that covered them. Mm-hmm. And we lived within walking distance of the Capitol, and bottles of bourbon, my father's spirit of choice,
yes,
would show up on our, row house front step. And there was no doubt where it came from. That's just the way things operated.
But do you think journalists are tougher today than they were back then, especially
well, they're
covering
certainly,
politicians?
Sure, yeah. There's certainly more of a distance, between the two. There's not the friendships. And that's the way it ought to be. I mean, you shouldn't be friends with people that you cover. You shouldn't be their guests at any events. You shouldn't go to ball games with them or, you know, anything like that.
You've been described. In fact, my colleague Dave Davies has a piece about you in Newsworks today.
Oh,
and,
great.
Which you should read.
I will.
But describing you and others describing you as a tough journalist.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Right.
That's good.
Do you think of yourself as a tough journalist?
Well, I mean, the description that the National Journal gave me some years back was he can take the skin off a politician without making it hurt too much.
Mm.
And, I mean, I try to walk a fine line. I know a lot of people will tell you that it's just a bitter old man mean streak that keeps me going. But I really do try not to embarrass people. But to tell the truth, I mean, if somebody is ineffective, if somebody is not accountable, I try to point that out.
Dave quotes someone at the Daily News as describing you as snarly. This is an unnamed editor calling you snarly. Do you embrace that?
Yes.
You do?
Sure. When Zach Stahlberg, the former editor of the Daily News, asked me if I would like to be a columnist, I, of course, said yes. And when he announced it, the word he used was snarky. And there were some politicians, when I told them I was going to be a columnist and start writing columns, who said, well, how will we know the difference?
Really?
Well, because the Daily News, God bless it, would always allow some leeway in coverage. And so, it wasn't like the paper of record type of reporting. So I had kind of a reputation going into that.
Are there things that you might take back? I mean, looking at 25 years of coverage, things where you felt like, this went too far, and not only did I take the skin off, but yeah. It hurt.
Yeah, there was one story, and I do talk about this in the book. It was during the Casey years. I had written a piece comparing then-Governor Casey to then-Governor Florio, and both had just raised taxes, and both had been called on by the Wall Street Journal as the biggest mistakes, fiscal mistakes of any states. And so this kind of inspired me to do a piece comparing them in all ways. Both had been athletes. Florio was a boxer. Casey played basketball at Holy Cross with Bob Cousy, the NBA Hall of Famer.
Wow.
And but Casey was at that point sick and much sicker than we knew. And he looked frail. He looked ashen. And Florio was kind of this robust, Florious kind of guy.
Yeah.
And so somebody at the very talented art department at the Daily News did like a couple of stick drawings of the two and made Florio look like Florio and sadly made Casey look like Casey. The response that I got to the piece from the governor's top aides varied from a handwritten note from the late, great Jim Haggerty, who was Casey's chief counsel, that just said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Right. And were you?
Well, the problem, Marty, was they knew something I didn't know, which was just how sick the governor was. And their outrage really came more from devotion to him and loyalty to him than any kind of sense of unfair journalism. I don't think the piece was unfair, knowing what I know. In retrospect, had I known more, it probably would have been a lot softer.
You got your first job as a reporter for the Harrisburg Patriot News, where your dad had worked.
Right.
This was 1972, as you said, the year of Tropical Storm Agnes and Watergate, I guess natural and man-made disaster. Right.
Right, or as I say in the book, it was a good time to get your feet wet.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, both stories provided all kinds of opportunities for young journalists. Harrisburg was hit very hard, as was a lot of Pennsylvania, by the hurricane. And we had to publish outside of the city, and we were, all of us were working outside of the city because the newspaper was flooded. But, you know, it made for great, great stories and great opportunities. And the Watergate thing, of course, had spinoffs for a decade in terms of politics and really changed the nature of journalism. You know, that, I think, was a big turning point in American journalism. And I was right there at the beginning
yeah.
of it.
Do you think Pennsylvania is any more corrupt than any other state?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of surveys, and we usually end up in the top three or four or five. I mean, Illinois has a pretty good reputation. New Jersey has a pretty good reputation. I think when you look at us in just the last few years, we may have caught up the number of leaders in the General Assembly, two former speakers, John Purcell and Bill DeWeese, both in prison. The most powerful senator in a generation, Vince Fumo, in prison. Leadership on both sides. I think there are like eight leaders who are now serving time. It's just been a real run. And these things tend to be cyclical. I mean, there was a period way back when a whole group of leaders and lawmakers went to prison, and we just passed through another one of those, and I suspect in another 10 years or so we'll see another round.
And do you think there have been reforms to deal with
not
what got these
enough.
People
no.
in trouble?
No, not nearly enough. I mean, there tend to be a little rush to kind of pull in the margins on the edge, but nobody goes to the fundamental reforms that really could make a difference. They just never get addressed because they would change things. And the Pennsylvania political system doesn't want change.
And is money at the root of that?
Absolutely.
I mean, the fact that there are, what, unlimited campaign donations?
We're one of only a handful of states where, for state races, which would include the legislature and all statewide offices, not federal offices, but state offices, there's no limit on what you can raise and spend. And that makes a tremendous amount of difference and is a great adherence for keeping incumbents. That, coupled with our gerrymandered system of redistricting, makes it tough to get any kind of change.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with John Baer in this hour of Radio Times. He often joins us by phone from Harrisburg. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News based in Harrisburg. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and he has a new book. It's called On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Also, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions about Pennsylvania politics? Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Currently on view at PAFA, The Female Gaze, Women Artists Making Their World. Over 200 works from the Linda Lee Alter Collection of Art by Women, featuring modern and contemporary artists' depictions of themselves and their communities, a multiplicity of aesthetic viewpoints, working methods, and political perspectives. More information online at PAFA.org. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY.
This Week in This American Life, growing up in Minnesota, John says that nobody ever talked about the war that happened near his hometown, Mankato, or the mass execution there.
The place where that hanging happened, I would have hung out at the mall not far from there, a few blocks down the street. I would have ridden past that spot on my way to, you know, Pizza Hut with my buddies.
For Thanksgiving, a story of Indians and settlers this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
When you think about Santa, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy, you probably think about lovable, cuddly guys or gals. But in the new film Rise of the Guardians, they bring out their tough side.
What we really wanted to do was kind of take a step to the side and present them in a totally new way.
Director Peter Ramsey is with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. And if you're just joining us, John Baer is our guest. He's an award-winning political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog, Baer Growls, can be found at philly.com. And again, the author of a new book called On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, you also described Pennsylvania as a kind of status quo conservatism. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the history of the state politically, first of all, as we were saying before the break, I mean, there's not a lot of change that takes place. Mm-hmm. I've often said that if the capital of Pennsylvania were in Philadelphia, we'd be a much more progressive state because there'd be a lot more attention by the media. The fact that the capital is in a minor media market. Nobody wants to go there. Nobody wants to report from there. No editor wants to publish anything from there. You know, it's been tough, particularly in the old days, to even get things into the newspaper out of there. Because if you think about it, I mean, Philadelphia is mayoral centric. I mean, most of the good reporting is done out of City Hall. And national news is right there, you know, for everybody. And state news kind of gets short shrift. So when you leave a powerful unit of government, and state government is increasingly powerful across America, when you leave a powerful unit of government virtually untouched, it's going to take care of itself, and that's what it's done. That's why we have, you know, the most expensive legislature in America, with the largest full-time staff of legislative staff in America. That's why we have consistently, I mean, take any measure of political progress, and we're not on the chart. And we seem very comfortable with that.
Well, I was going to say, why do Pennsylvanians put up with that? Or maybe that's what Pennsylvanians want?
Well, I mean, it's possible. I mean, there might be some sense of, you know, no government is good government or less government is good government. But it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the combination of unlimited campaign funding and politically decided legislative districts just keeps things kind of, you know, quiet and the same year after year after year.
But we have a lot of government. I mean, we certainly have I know this is something that rankles you.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at Pennsylvania, there's like 2,500 municipalities, 500 school districts, 67 counties. as mentioned, the largest full-time legislature in America. You would think we'd be doing government well. Plus, we're the birth of the nation, the cradle of democracy. I mean, what, you know, we ought to be the state that sets the model for good government and good citizenship. And it just hasn't turned out that way.
Well, as you say in the book, it looks like, from your perspective, a combination of geography, as you were describing, but also apathy and a kind of parochialism.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we consistently trail usually half the states in voter turnout. And the real number to look at, Marty, is what's called the voting age population, the VAP. And we're pretty far down the list when it comes to other states that were not the birthplace of democracy. And I mean, that apathy plays into the partisanship that we have and, I mean, actually encourages it. And the geography sets up, you know, you have these seven different media markets, many of them culturally different, different wants, different needs. When people poll priority issues in different parts of the state, they come back with different results. Yeah. And so it becomes very tough for a governor or a legislature to agree on anything that covers everybody. So we see, you know, no real progress in education reform, no real progress in political reform, no real progress in healthcare reform, because everybody has different wants and different needs.
Well, you have mentioned the LCB, and this is a vestige of prohibition.
Right.
And how many governors, how many people have gone to Harrisburg saying that they're going to privatize or get rid of the LCB? It's still with us.
It's still with us, yeah. It was a big agenda item for Governor Thornburg. It was a big agenda item for Governor Ridge. It is a big agenda item for Governor Corbett. And there's no movement.
Let me get to it. Looks like Wally from Bella Vista to join us on Radio Times. And Wally, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
My question, is, and John touched on a little bit, was the size of our General Assembly. I'm curious to know what, if any, effect shrinking the size of that General Assembly and with it the size of the overall staff would have on maybe rooting out some of the corruption and initiating a wave of reform.
Wally, let me see what John Boehner has to say. Do you think that would help?
Well, it's a great question, and there is a huge debate. I mean, a serious debate. I mean, the obvious sort of populist thing is to say, look, it's too big, we should cut it. But there is a serious academic debate, and the public affairs at Temple did a terrific series, the Temple Papers, on the legislature, in which they mount the arguments for and against a reduced size. And there are some people that say, well, look, you mean it would disconnect people further from their government. But, I mean, my argument has always been, you know, how many people actually contact their state representatives or even know who they are? And I think Wally's right. I mean, I think a smaller legislature would not only be more effective because you wouldn't have to deal with so many committees, you wouldn't have to deal with so many people, you wouldn't need to collect so many votes to get anything done. But it would clearly save an awful lot of money. If you don't have a big legislator, you don't need a big staff. And that money could go to things that the rest of Pennsylvania could use a lot better than the people that hang out in the Capitol.
You're saying there's a lot of duplication of...
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, you know, multiple committees. Every caucus has, you know, resources. Every caucus has slush funds. You know, they keep money for their own purposes. And the, you know, every year, in fact, the speaker, the current speaker of the House, Sam Smith, from Punxsutawney, has a bill that would reduce the size of the legislature gradually, which is really the smart way to do it over time. And, of course, that bill's gone nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, what legislature would reduce its own self?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would take a sustained, multi-year, well-financed advocacy group to demand that and get it on a ballot somehow.
You actually took a little break from your career as a journalist to become the press secretary for Bill Scranton. He was running for governor. This was back in the
80s, right? 1986.
Why did you want to sign on to his campaign?
Well, I had been working in public broadcasting, which I loved, doing public affairs documentary work for WITF, which was then based in beautiful Hershey, PA. But I was doing a lot of freelancing, including for Philadelphia Magazine and for the Washington Post. And Philly Magazine asked me to do a profile of this young guy that was going to run for lieutenant governor in 1978, Bill Scranton. And all I got was a one-sheet thing that said Yale, Switzerland, and Transcendental Meditation. And I thought, well, we might be
what
able
an
to
interesting
have some fun.
Combination, right?
Might be able to have some fun with this. So I planned sort of my usual snarky kind of coverage of Scranton, and then I spent some time with him on the campaign trail. He and I were the same age. He was exceedingly accessible, very comfortable in his skin, obviously comes from a very wealthy family, and really seemed dedicated to public service, as his father was. Right. And, you know, I kind of liked the guy. So after I did the piece, we stayed in touch socially. And when he decided to run for governor, he asked if I was interested in coming along. And by that time, I was ready for something new. And so joined his office and the lieutenant governor and became his press secretary.
And up against Bob Casey, another very well-known Pennsylvania
name. Up against
name.
The real Bob Casey. And you also, know, it's an interesting thing, Marty, if I can just slip this
please.
In. A friend of mine, R.B. Swift, who's also a journalist for the Scranton Papers and has written a couple of historical books, just pointed out to me that, you know, Scranton gets an inordinate amount of politicians that become famous or infamous. And Bob Mello, the current senator, is going to be sentenced this Friday. Ernie Priate, the former attorney general, went to prison. But we had two families, the Scranton family and the Casey family, who served the state with distinction without a hint of scandal. And then you had like this next layer where northeastern Pennsylvania, the two judges, I know you had Billy Eckenbarger on this week with his book Kids for Cash, the two judges from Luzerne County. And you just, I mean, there's what is it about that area of the state? But anyway, I thought it was interesting, and R.B. Swift pointed that out. So, yeah, the Scranton-Casey race was initially, everybody thought Scranton's a shoe-in.
Sure, sure.
He was young. He was vibrant. Casey was back for the third time to run again for governor. And you never know. It didn't turn out that way.
Well, and as you said, this TM, Transcendental Meditation, looks like that was held against him or used against him. Also, he admitted drug use.
Yeah. And it was fascinating in retrospect. And a lot of people will forget this. I, of course, have it emblazoned in my mind. That summer, Lenny Bias, who was a first-team All-American basketball player from Maryland, a first-round draft choice for the Boston Celtics, died of a drug overdose. That fall, then-President Reagan and Nancy Reagan went on national television with the Just Say No campaign. So despite the fact that Scranton, from the time he was elected in 1978 through the early part of the campaign in 1986, had openly talked about the fact that he had experimented with drugs as a college student at Yale, drugs suddenly became a national obsession. And so when he again said basically the same thing he had said for years, it became a national story. And brought some unwanted attention to somebody running, a younger guy running in a socially conservative state.
And as press secretary, you had to, fend off some of these questions or navigate around them?
Yeah. I mean, CBS News called one night, CBS Radio News out of New York, and said, you know, we'd like to talk to him about this. And I said, yeah, he's had a long day. I mean, he's probably asleep by now. And I'm thinking, please go away.
Right. And you learned to lie in this job,
right? Well, yeah. No, he did have a long day. I mean, I didn't lie to the person. But I said, look, if you really need something, call me back in half an hour and I'll give you some quotes. Fortunately for me, unfortunately for others, there was a terrorist attack on an airliner somewhere in Europe, and the story got pushed to the next day, which was a Saturday, which was a little bit helpful. But the point being that, yeah, there were some dicey moments over, you know, how to deal with the drug thing. We had made a decision to go and talk to schools about it, and we did that, even though our pollster was saying we shouldn't even utter the words. But Bill wanted to keep it out there and talk about it and try to use it to his advantage. Mm.
And that's John Baer, our guest today on Radio Times. And we often call him up when we want to talk about Pennsylvania politics. He's been reporting on the legislature in Harrisburg on Pennsylvania for 25 years now for the Philadelphia Daily News as a columnist. He's now an author, and his new book is called On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. Any questions or comments, do give us a call at 1-888-477-4373. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Just a quick question about James Carville, who, of course, has gone on to fame and fortune. But he said something about Pennsylvania, and I've seen it quoted and misquoted. What did he say about Pennsylvania?
What he actually said, and he was, Marty, he ran Governor Casey's, I mean, then Bob Casey's campaign in 1986. It was the first win for James Carville and Paul Begala. Begala was with him also. But Carville, in explaining Pennsylvania, said, everything between Paoli and Squirrel Hill is Alabama without black people.
Whoa.
Now, that's become, you know, because people, a lot of people don't know where Paoli or Squirrel Hill is, that's become everything between Philly and Pittsburgh is Alabama without black people. And he was largely right and is largely right. I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of change in the middle. There's been changes at either end, but there hasn't been a lot of change in the middle. He was and is, as you know, quite a character.
Yes, he is.
the first time I met him, I think we were negotiating debate stuff in the 86 campaign, and I thought, my God, this guy's from Mars. You know, where did he come from? But I do mention this in the book. He also ran Harris Wofford's campaign in 1991 against Dick Thornburgh. Mm-hmm. Thornburgh ran a horrible campaign, and Wofford really wanted to stay in the United States Senate, having been appointed after John Hines died. And Carville would call literally on a daily basis. I was, you know, then reporting for the Daily News on the race and would call in his accent. Of course, he was immediately identifiable. And I'd pick up the phone. He'd say, Bayer. And I'd say, hello.
Bayer. That's right.
You know, Bayer. I'd say, hello, James. He said, it's Carville. I said, yes, I know. How are you? He said, Bayer, what are they doing? Meaning the Thornburgh campaign. He said, I mean, if it were you, wouldn't you be doing something? And I said, I don't know what to tell you, James. He said, okay, got to go. Bye. You know, and that would be it. But I mean, the daily calls. To his credit, I mean, James is really at heart a nice guy. I mean, we stayed in touch for years afterwards. I saw him a couple times in Washington, and I mean, there just isn't anybody like him on the political scene.
Well, I know in this campaign there was at least an effort to try to make it not negative.
It didn't last
very long.
It was a bold move. I mean, it was Scranton's decision to stop all negative campaigning and go positive, and we made a television spot to that effect that got enormous attention nationally. The Wall Street Journal called it, the biggest risk in modern American politics. Tom Wicker, then with the New York Times, wrote about it. And we got great positive reviews editorially in Pennsylvania and a lot of support built. But then something bad happened.
What happened?
There was a mailer that had been ordered stopped when we had done the thing, but it went out anyway. And on the mailer, and it was like 600,000 of them. So, you know, it's hard. Anyway, it went out, and it attacked Casey for his time as Auditor General, which is largely regarded as the watchdog job of the state, because he was also collecting a salary from a law firm in Philadelphia. And we said, you know, some watchdog, he's getting paid while all this corruption in the Schapp administration was going on, blah, 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 on and on and on. And the AP called me on a Saturday and asked if our stop on negative campaigning extended to brochures.
Oh, wow.
And of course, the first thing I thought was, "Oh God!" I didn't know anything about it. I said, "Let me find out." And then Tommy Farrick called from the then, you know, he was with the Inquirer, then top political reporter, and said, "I think you guys made a mistake. I think I'm going to have to write about it." And this is a Saturday in the fall. I said, "Tom, you know, the metropolitan Philadelphia area probably has a number of terrific collegiate football games going on this afternoon. Wouldn't your time be better spent, you know, enjoying the autumn?"
He said,
"No." Yeah,
regrettably,
I couldn't convince him. So that was bad. Casey then held a news conference in front of a stack of 60,000 mailers and said, called Scranton a hypocrite and said, you know, how can you make a mistake like this? Refused to do a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette editorial joint session with him because he said he didn't want to be in a room with somebody who says one thing and does another. And it really hurt us.
Yeah. But fair criticism.
Fair criticism.
Having worked for a while with someone on a campaign, does it give you sympathy for what it's like to run for office, even in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, tremendous. It's like anybody who has any sort of injury and has to spend time on crutches in a wheelchair gets a real appreciation for people with disabilities. I feel that way about politicians. It is more than a notion to run for public office. I mean, it is tough. It is exhausting. You're under a microscope. And when you run for a significant office in a state as big as Pennsylvania, it's a challenge. So I do have empathy with people who do that, because you can see the toll when you're inside a campaign like that. You can see the toll it takes on individuals physically, psychologically, on their families, on everybody around them. So, yeah, I do. That's a good point.
Well, and we're almost having a break here, and I haven't interviewed the number of politicians as you have, but sometimes do interview them when they're running for office, and I have to say sometimes they come in here just dragging.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes they frankly don't even know, look like they know where they are.
I can believe it. Yeah.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We have some callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John Baer is our guest, one of our favorite guests to talk about Pennsylvania politics. He's an award-winning political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog is Baer Growls. It can be found at philly.com. And he's the author of a new book called On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. We'll take a short break. Then I do want to talk about Arlen Specter, Ed Randell, and some others as well. And again, we'll take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY and announces the 2012 We Remember Gala, this year honoring the Wistar Institute, Friday, November 30th from 6 to 9 p.m. For more than 20 years, Philadelphia Fight has worked to combat HIV through research, treatment, prevention, and education. The We Remember Gala serves as a reminder that HIV remains a challenge and also honors those lost to the disease. For tickets and details, 215-525-8628 or fight.org.
What's happening in Israel, Gaza, Egypt, Syria, Iran, Iraq, it's all interconnected with a lot of shifting and paradoxical alliances that are difficult to explain, which is why on the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Malley, the International Crisis Group's Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Author David K. Johnston lists 12 ways to protect against the next Hurricane Sandy. First on the list, increased spending on infrastructure. Also, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends doctors give girls under 17 just-in-case prescriptions for the morning after pill. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with John Baer about 25 years of Pennsylvania politics and politicians. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You covered Arlen Specter, who died not so long ago, a couple of months ago, after fighting cancer and a brain tumor. I mean, it seems as if during his career that almost nothing would stop him, but obviously he finally succumbed.
Yeah, I always used to write that the only way he'd go out of the U.S. Senate would be feet first, and that almost came to pass.
Yeah.
Marty, there was nobody other than Ed Randell who was more fun to be with on the campaign trail or elsewhere than Arlen Specter. And when you look at his life, I mean, what an extraordinary life. I mean, really in the thick of virtually every major historical event from the time that he was the district attorney here in Philadelphia. And people forget, when he was elected to the United States Senate in 1980, he won in an eight-way Republican primary with 36% of the vote, and then won the general election against Pete Flaherty, then the mayor of Pittsburgh, who was a horrible campaigner, with 50.2% of the vote.
Wow.
So he narrowly became United States Senator. I wrote a piece for the Pittsburgh Press Sunday magazine when it was still in existence about Arlen running for re-election, and made the point that this is somebody that nobody liked that kept getting re-elected, and, you know, tried to examine why that was. And the why that was that he was that extraordinarily rare combination in a politician who was exceedingly smart and voracious. I mean, willing to do anything to get and stay in office.
Yeah.
This is somebody who went to every county, each of the 67 counties, every year, election year or not, And I used to torture him by asking him if he could name them all. And he would actually do it. I mean, he would start, well, you're Erie and McKay and so
on. With that voice
of
his.
Yeah, you know, and I would say, please stop. And then Forrest and Fulton, you know, just go on and on. But, I mean, people don't appreciate the fact that, you know, he only did comedy near the end of his career, some stand-up comedy. But he always had this enormously funny sense of humor, very wry and very, very cutting. And it was just always a joy to be with him.
And was he Snarlin' Arlin'?
I mean, absolutely, Snarlin' Arlin'. Yeah, I mean, his turnover rate in his Senate office was extraordinary. He routinely was named by Washington magazines as the meanest man in the Senate.
Yeah.
And you know, but I never saw that side of him. And I guess it was because of what I did for a living. I mean, he didn't show me that side. He showed me a much funnier, but you know, also snarky kind of side. But
it is interesting. Even if he won by narrow majorities, he was almost beaten by Lynn Yackel after the Anita Hill grilling. But someone that seemed to not have that sort of Ed Rendell type personality.
Totally different. Alike in a lot of ways in terms of their grasp of issues, their native intelligence, their sense of politics, and ability to raise money and how to win elections.
Yeah.
But definitely different people in terms of their outgoingness and personality. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you actually read a section from your book. It's on page 98, and this is Ed Rendell. It's the summer of 2000. He's chairman of the Democratic National Committee. He is out in Los Angeles. He's being driven around by a driver. And late to just about everything, as you describe. And John, you're in this limousine as these two essentially do their comedy routine.
Yeah. He had hired this young driver who, in the course of the weeks or so Ed was there, had become as crazy as Ed. And so I wrote a column from Los Angeles, and this is part of it. The cell phones keep cutting out. It's an L.A. thing, causing Rendell to rant and rave and curse and sputter and then to laugh. He and his driver, 33-year-old Los Angelino Mark Holmes, do a bit that involves Holmes imitating Rendell's growling, gravelly voice. "Oh, L.A. sucks," says Holmes. "L.A. sucks," echoes Rendell. Then they both crack up. They launch into a routine pretending to field donors' request. "You suck. Hang up the phone," hollers Holmes. Where have you been all year? You haven't done for us," yells Rendell. They scream at traffic, mock their chances of being anywhere on time. "Not in the cards," again howls of laughter. They revel in tales of junk food, each calling out the name of local favorites. "Fat burger," yells Rendell. "Okie dog," offers Holmes. They are clearly people punchy with fatigue. Rendell says he's getting 3.5 hours of sleep a night. Holmes logged 109 hours in 1 week, driving Rendell in a black Cadillac DeVille with tinted windows for $56 an hour. Holmes occasionally pops in a set of false crooked teeth. Rendell swears Holmes was normal when they met. Quote, "I ruined a human being. I feel some responsibility for him. I might have to bring him back to Pennsylvania," Rendell says. Holmes adds, "I'll never be the same."
And there you were, just taking
enjoying
notes.
It all, right.
And what does that tell you, us, about Ed Rendell?
Well, he's crazy, of course. I mean, everybody knows that he knows that. But again, like Arlen, I mean, he's one of those people that journalists just love to be with. Mm-hmm. Unpredictable, always fun, always funny.
You also describe, for a time, he was making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And you added up all his various teaching gigs and working in a law firm in Philadelphia.
Right, yeah.
Doing very well for himself.
Doing very well for himself.
Let me see what Doris from Westchester has to say. And Doris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Doris.
Oh, yes. My question is there any hope that we will ever have a reform of the redistricting in Pennsylvania in order to eliminate the gerrymandering that has gone to such extremes that I really don't think, well, as in many states in the country, I really don't think that we're getting fair election returns.
Well, Doris,
nationally, particularly.
I hear you.
Well, even that's not true. It's both national and state.
State by state. Thanks for calling into Radio Times, John Baird. Do you think we will ever get redistricting reform?
No. Because of redistricting, which is in effect for 10 years, done only after every 10-year census, whatever party happens to be in power in Pennsylvania, that's the Republican Party, has the opportunity and uses it to set the lines. And so they obviously do so in their own favor. So it would take, as I said earlier, Marty, it would take a real sea change in not only the way people vote in the state, but probably a sustained, well-funded education campaign across Pennsylvania to get people's attention and to say, look, this is a fundamental issue of democracy. If you really want better representation, less partisan representation, more reflective representation, we've got to change the way we do redistricting.
And some states have done that. I mean,
some
they've
states
had
have
outside
done that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Iowa, for example, they just have a grid. I mean, it's just a flat-out grid. And, you know, you cut it up that way. But, I mean, it's set by our Constitution. It's just such a hassle to try to get it changed. And the people that can do it are the people who benefit from it the way it is. So I'm very bleak about any prospect for that getting better.
Doris, thanks for the call. Let's see what Gordon from Westchester has to say. Gordon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, John. This is Gordon Woodrow.
Hey, Gordon. How are you, man?
Who is this? I'm sorry, Gordon who?
Gordon
Woodrow.
Woodrow, okay.
Gordon was one of Arlen's chief of staff.
Oh, there you go. Go ahead, Gordon.
The first one. I just wanted to give you a little anecdote about Arlen. You know that he would like a vodka martini once in a while.
I've heard that.
And but he would never drink in public. And he always drank with, you know, moderation. But one night, for some reason, we were at an event in Georgetown, and I was with him. And he had had one martini before he spoke. And after it was over on the way back to the hill, I said to him, you know, Arlen, you ought to have a drink, just one drink before you speak more often. And he says, Gordon, are you underwhelmed by my performance? And I said, no, actually, you seem to be a lot more relaxed, more comfortable. It was really, really very good. And I said, it actually looked like you were enjoying yourself for a change. And he said, Gordon, you have to remember, I barely like my friends. So that sort of encapsulated him all in one little event.
That's great.
Oh, that's great. Well, we should have a, sound like Arlen Specter Day on Radio Times. And
well,
have our...
there are a number. There's John Denny, who works for Elsie Hillman out in Pittsburgh, who made... probably does the best.
He does a good one.
But there are a number of people that have done it. It was an unusual accent that he had. It wasn't. He came from the same town as
Bob Dole
in Russell, Kansas, and amazing. Bob Dole didn't sound anything like him.
No, I know.
And Arlen never spoke in the third person. So,
right.
Gordon, I appreciate the call to Radio Times.
Good to hear from you, man.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks
great.
A lot. Gordon Woodrow, Arlen Specter's first chief of staff. You can call as well. You don't have to have worked for Arlen Specter to call in at 1-888-477-9499. John, I'd love to have you read another section from your book. This is actually a part of page 107, and this is the race for lieutenant governor in 02. Catherine Baker Knoll is running against a number of candidates, and you have what I think is just a hilarious description of this debate.
Yeah, this was a great debate. A friend of mine pointed out, Marty, there are two recurrent lines in the book that I really hadn't noticed. One was, I am not making this up.
Right.
And the other one was, he also went to prison. both appear multiple times. But this was a debate in 2002 for the office of lieutenant governor. Catherine Baker Knoll strongly asserted she always had and always will want to, quote, help the female people. Green Tree Borough, south of Pittsburgh, Councilman Ron Panza, who the moderator kept calling Mr. Panzer, said, quote, for the record, I am anti-toxic waste. Edward Truax, a Harrisburg artist and writer sporting a dangling cross earring and a haircut that can kindly be called non-traditional for a political candidate, announced that he'd been in a coma for a month. given the office he was seeking, this could actually be an asset. One candidate, Scott Conklin of Center County, withdrew from the race during the debate. No one could blame him. And rambling, often incomprehensible answers to questions on gun control were so painful that the Inquirer's Tom Fitzgerald, next to me at the press table, leaned in to whisper, quote, "I certainly believe in the Second Amendment right now."
And that truly happened, right?
Truly happened. Not making this up.
And she was the lieutenant governor when Ed Rendell was the governor.
Yeah, yeah. One of the bad things we do is elect them, separately. So Rendell did not necessarily want Catherine Baker Knoll to be lieutenant governor, but she won.
And one cheesesteak away from being governor, as you write.
One cheesesteak away.
You also describe, I guess it's the food bill for Ed Rendell's first year as governor, the food bill from the governor's mansion.
It was a wonderful story. Ed Rendell followed in the tradition of prior governors by hosting a very nice annual Christmas party at the governor's mansion for the media, until the Pittsburgh Tribune Review wrote a scathing piece, having gotten a hold through the Right to Know Freedom of Information Act of Rendell's food bills. And they were, for his first year in office, just astronomical.
$78,000 or something?
Yeah, right. And compared to, like, the governor of Ohio, whose food bill was, like, $14,000 or something. But the bills had details. I mean, you could actually see what was being eaten. And Rendell already had this reputation as an extraordinary eater, someone who would eat off your plate at receptions, someone on campaign buses who would literally put a towel over his chest before digging into a hoagie or something and just look at everybody and say, "This is off the record." And, you know, as I say in the book, it should remain so.
Yes, exactly.
But the thing that I thought was funny about the fact that the Rendell administration made the decision they were not going to cooperate with the reporter from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and so he was left to make his own assumptions. Then Rendell got really pissed off and called him in along with – had the reporter there, had his chief of staff, that's time John Estey there, and went over line by line stuff that – you know, he said, "This is what the first lady eats for breakfast." And it was just amazing. I mean, we're in the middle of all these legislative issues, and the governor of the Commonwealth, one of the largest states of America, is sitting down with a reporter explaining that the first lady – has an English muffin with peanut butter and coffee every morning. It just struck me as, you know, amazingly funny.
Well, the current governor, Tom Corbett, you describe as the either anti-Rendell or the un-Rendell.
Yeah, the anti-Rendell. And he used that to his advantage when he was running for office and has referred to it many times in his early term. He is not a policy wonk. He is not a glad-hander. He is not a politician. He comes from a prosecutorial background as the only jobs he's held except for a private sector job with Waste Management as counsel. And, he does not engage, has not been visible, everything that Ed was. And a lot of people say, well, that's good. We needed a break. We need somebody who's more serious and all of that. But, I mean, I think that, you know, people also want somebody who they see and hear from as their political leader a little bit more than Governor Corbett has allowed thus far. But he is, without question, the anti-Ed.
We're almost out of time here, but he said recently in a radio interview that he finds this is a hard job to be governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's what George Bush said about, and you remember that when George Bush in the 2004 debate with John Kerry, I think 11 times said it was a hard job. Look, people, nobody expects – governing isn't easy. You know that going in. It just bemuses me when anyone who we feed, house, and clothe complains about being a hard job. That's why you ran, to do some work.
Well, John Baer, thank you so much for joining
us
today on Radio
me.
Times. And again, the book is called On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, 25 Years of Keystone Reporting. John Baer, our guest, he's a columnist based in Harrisburg, writes for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's speaking tonight at the Pen and Pencil Club, which is here in Philadelphia. It's a club for journalists. And for more information about Radio Times, in fact, if you go to our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter, more information about John Baer. I'm Artie Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.